Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Lab Medicine podcast series. I'm Kelly Swales. I'm the web editor of Lab Medicine magazine. Today I have with me Dr. Charles Severs. He's going to talk a little bit with us about disseminated intravascular coagulation, laboratory support for management and treatment.
All right, Kelly. Thank you for that warm introduction. So I'll go ahead and jump into this article. The abstract here kind of gives us an idea of its overall layout. It's of a simulated case with an 18-year-old male who presents to the ER with 3 weeks worth of nosebleeds and fatigue. And the authors here have actually put together kind of a little interesting case that really connects all the different areas of the lab and how we would support a patient out on the floor in DIC. Going into this guy's history, it's pretty much unremarkable past medical history and negative for any childhood history of bleeding, which is always important to ask about. In addition, he has no family history of bleeding. There's many genetic conditions out there involving the coagulation system which need to be considered. Medications is the next thing to ask on his history. Here they provided us no medications that he's on. We go next to the physical exam, and we see some clot and petechial hemorrhages, and those are little microvascular hemorrhages in his mouth and lower extremities. So there is some sort of microvascular damage that's occurred in this particular patient. They've provided us some labs here. So this would be concordant with an initial workup with a CBC, a basic metabolic profile, a PT, an APTT, which is pretty basic for any hospital admission involving bleeding. So at this point, the patient's admitted to the hospital based on the findings of Table 1, and I'll go through those individually with you. The white blood cell count is 7.7. That's actually within our reference range. And you'll look and you'll see that the red blood cell count is lowered. You'll notice that his hemoglobin is also markedly lowered, 6.7. The lower end of the reference range that we have for males is 13.7. Hematocrit is also concordantly lower. The other things to point out here, his reticulocyte count is high, it's elevated because he's trying to compensate for all this blood that he's losing over the last 3 weeks. Platelet count is also diminished quite a bit. Our lower end of the reference level is 161, and our patient is actually at 9, which is a critical level, really. That would probably be time to transfuse him some platelets below 10,000 per milliliter is usually the cutoff. Now, we also have a differential that's here. It kind of gives us an idea of what's going on with the white count. Even though the white count is normal, we see that the metamyelocytes are elevated. We see promyelocytes elevated quite a bit. In addition to that, we see myocytes and myeloblasts, which should generally not be in the circulating blood. Lymphocytes and monocytes compose a smaller number of that absolute count as well. So we know at that point that there's something interesting going on here because there's an odd maturation that's occurring out in our differential. In addition to that, we start looking at the prothrombin time and the activated partial thromboplastin time, and we see that both of those are elevated. It's taking longer for this individual to clot than what a normal person would within our reference range, so to speak. In addition to that, we notice that fibrinogen, the precursor to fibrin, is decreased, so we're exhausting it for some reason or another. And then we also notice D-dimer, which is actually a product of fibrin breakdown. So if you think back to the coagulation cascade, there's actually a pretty good little figure in here later on. Fibrin gets recycled at a certain point, clots get broken down, and D-dimer is a product of that. And I would encourage you, if you have a Henry's clinical diagnostic manual around, there's a really good figure in the coagulation system that shows what the actual D-dimer molecule looks like. At this point, we can diagnose this individual with disseminated intravascular coagulation because we see that there's a consumptive process. We see that his PT and his APTT are both elevated, and then we're also seeing the breakdown products of the D-dimer. So what's happening here is he's clotting all over his body. He's making these little microvascular hemorrhages in his capillary beds, and all of his fibrin's being used up. After that fibrin's being used up, we see the resulting decrease in the clotting factors and thus increasing our clotting times because he's consuming all of his factors which are present out in the circulation typically. So we always have to ask, whenever you have DIC or are in the condition of DIC, what's going on in the background? What's causing it? So the interesting thing, at least in this patient, is that he has the subtype of AML called acute promyelocytic leukemia, M3, and we know that based upon the CBC is abnormal, and once we get over to the peripheral smear findings, particularly image number 2, whenever we finally do look at the peripheral blood, we notice there's promyelocytes that are here. They're kind of cerebriform in their look. They have large nuclei. They have a really fine chromatin pattern as described. There's the presence of multiple rod-shaped structures. Those are called hour rods. You'll notice that in that big promyelocyte that's to your left. Hour rods are kind of toward the bottom of that cell in the picture. So based on all of these findings, we can say that he has DIC secondary to AML, which is a really common finding, at least in M3 in the old FAB system, even though it's archaic, it's still being used, and an easy way to kind of classify the AMLs. So what's going on in acute promyelocytic leukemia? We confirm that with molecular studies, of course. So in PML, retinoic acid receptor gene fuses with the RARA gene. So PML plus RARA gene on chromosome 17 fuse together, and that's how we detect it molecularly and confirm our impression via the peripheral blood smear. So hemostasis always is accounting for things being in balance. The authors here suggest that endothelium, platelets, coagulation factors, and fibromyelinic tissue repair systems are all in a balance of sorts. But whenever we release all the granules that are in these promyelocytes, which are quite fragile, they can cause us to lose that balance. Once we get into DIC, it becomes kind of a vicious cycle at a certain point. So we have thrombosis first because we use up all those coagulation factors, as we described earlier, our APTT. And our PT both start to elevate over time after we've consumed our factors. And then we start to see that decrease in fibrinogen after we've used it all up. And then once our clot breaking down systems start coming online, we start seeing more of this fibrin that becomes degraded. Then we'll also see, in addition to D-dimer fibrin degradation products, which are a little bit less specific. So once we have all those in play, how does that contribute to this patient's thrombocytopenia and his anemia? Once we've used up all of our fibrin, once we've made all these clots, platelets do come into play because they're part of our clotting system too. So they get stuck onto these clots and become part of this endothelial damage, trying to take care of all these bleeds that are occurring all over. And then we have red blood cells that start getting trapped in there and start getting sheared off as we have all these fibrin webs that are accumulating within the capillary system. It makes it difficult for them to squeeze through and sometimes cuts them apart. So how does this all relate back to APL or acute promyelocytic leukemia? There's a strong association, DIC to APL, as I mentioned. There's a really big lawsuit potential if you don't recognize acute promyelocytic leukemia, especially on a peripheral smear in the pathology world. It's virtually fatal if it's not treated, and it's about 56% of the cases of acute promyelocytic leukemia that comes in the door. So how do you recognize it? It's going to be the circulating blast. It's going to be the hour rods. They're going to be myeloperoxidase positive. So these are going to be rich in tissue factor, which starts to activate the extrinsic coagulation system, which you'll see over on figure 1. So how do we take care of these individuals? It's quite frequent to see these folks over in the bone marrow transplant unit. The main thing is to support them with components in the transfusion section. But the first thing, of course, is always to treat the cause. There's a multitude of things which can cause it, sepsis being probably near the top of the list. You want to support with plasma, platelets, cryoprecipitate, because these people, they're using up their platelets in massive quantities. They're using up all their factors in massive quantities, and they're also going to be destroying red blood cells in that process. You're going to monitor the effect with both PT and APTT as you're transfusing, and then depending upon what they need, you're going to be using FFP, possibly factors 5, 8, or FFP within 24 hours, or thawed plasma, all kind of equivalent within a certain degree. So for other antifibrinolytics that are out there, you can use heparin, you can use antithrombin or protein C. Those have not been explored as much as probably plasma has. So really, to summarize, in the lab, to support and facilitate the diagnosis on the floor, folks in pathology really have to be at the forefront of this one and have a really increased sensitivity to acute promyelocytic leukemia, number 1, because it can lead to this complication, And number two, the folks over in coagulation have to be wary and monitoring this type of stuff. So whenever a critical value gets sent out, it needs to make it to the floor quite quickly. So you don't want to drop the ball on BIC or APL, both, because they're such a lawsuit potential and can be resulting in death. So they're both important considerations for patient care in summary. All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate this opportunity to podcast with you all.
Thanks, Dr. Beavers, for talking with us today about DIC. I know I found it informative, and I hope our listeners did too.